So why don't you guys buckle up and join the ride, because we're going to have some fun going green.
And Abby said you shouldn't commit illegal acts, except perhaps at night and with your parents' permission.
Your advice is making less sense than usual.
Well, the important thing is family and friendship, honesty, values, and no one got arrested.
You see this jerk? This is the same thing. Kropotkin was the same jerk, and Bakunin was the same jerk. Not good. Not good, I'm telling you.
He was a very good dancer.
He's a lowlife.
George Orwell, who definitely didn't like socialism of any kind, warned us against this. He wrote books that said that totalitarianism is bad and that sticking with old ideas is good.
I got news for you. You gotcha. Did you know population again?
I did not know that.
I never thought you'd lose a Stalin debate.
You never expect to walk into one.
Sure.
Avoid Marxism. Or telling her you're a Trotskyite.
Trotskyist. Only a Stalinist would call the Trotskyist a Trotskyite. And I'm not a Trotskyist anymore. I'm a Maoist.
Relentlessly anti-Trump and relentlessly pro somebody like Obama.
I'm not pro-Obama. I've been a critic of Obama. I'm a critic of the Democratic Party.
Because
I'm literally a communist.
Well, you know how it is. The main thing is to get those juicy likes and subscribes. And we can get some more of that sweet, sweet communist money rolling in. You know how it is, bro. Gotta get that communist dollar, gotta make it to the top.
Just imagine somebody saying under cannibalism or under slavery or under dictatorship, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, they'd be wrong. There is something you can do about it. You can get beyond these archaic systems and move closer and closer to fulfilling human capacities. And that's what we need to do.
Okay, welcome, welcome to the Three Left Show. I am your host, Dan Platt. This is the Three Left Show, leftist reading hour for the curious or the committed, for going in a different direction. Now to go to the greenwashing stories I was talking about. I've got a journey for you. The first story, so it's kind of one of those, I'm going to start with a really positive story and then kind of go like, well, if you think that's nice, we'll get to it. Well, whatever. So the first story is from the Good News Network. Let's have some good news, right? Can't all be bad. But there's some, what's the opposite of a silver lining? Black lining? Bronze lining? I don't know. Copper lining? No. Still valuable metals. Lead lining. Lead lining to these stories that I will point out. But in the Good News Network, the headline is Ocean Cleanup Makes History by Successfully Collecting First Plastic from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Now, I think for a good 6 years now, it's been public knowledge, but I'll give you a reminder. Great Garbage Patch. Let's go through it. For the first time in history, conservationists have collected trash from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch for recycling. Recycling industry that is not very effective, but let's go on. After 1 year of testing, the Ocean Cleanup Organization, that's what it's called apparently, announced this week that their system 001/B vessel, wonderful name. I'm going to rag on that a few more times because they don't call it anything else, is successfully capturing and collecting plastic debris. After many kind of maybe feel good this week now videos about, you know, people testing ideas for collecting trash from water. The self-contained system uses the natural forces of the ocean to passively catch and concentrate plastic in the Great Garbage Patch, thereby confirming the most important principle behind the cleanup project, first presented by a Boland Slat back in late 2012. So that timeline is something I'm going to rang over by the end of this story. The patch is a massive island of trash drifting halfway between California and Hawaii. Over a trillion pieces of debris have collected there because of the swirling vortex of current. Now, of course, now saying the cause of it being an island there, the cause of the plastic in the ocean is our heavily non-disposable society in which plastic is thrown into our watersheds and it goes to the ocean. Or sometimes trash is just outright dumped into the ocean. After discovering the patch in the 90s, 30 years ago, scientists said it would take thousands of years to clean it up. But Slat quickly made, so maybe with tools at the time, but Slat quickly made a name for himself, great PR, after he presented a TED Talk in which he claimed that he could do it in less than 10. if he could get his special machinery built. Now, timeline, it's taken 10 years to get the prototype built. Though his claim caused many skeptics to raise their eyebrows, Slatt dropped out of college so he could bring his plans to life. In addition, he crowdfunded $2 million for his idea. He garnered millions more from interested investors. So, do they expect to make money from collecting trash from the ocean? That's one of the problems with markets. You need investors, and investors want returns. Now the system doesn't have a name, but it has a number, you know, 001B vessel, which launched from Vancouver in June, is the Ocean Cleanup's second attempt to prove its concept of collecting garbage from the Great Garbage Patch. In addition to collecting plainly visible pieces of plastic debris, as well as much larger ghost nets associated with commercial fishing, the system has also successfully captured microplastics as small as 1 millimeter, a feat which the organization was pleasantly surprised to achieve. Very good. And that's because likely it's a passive system, so every little bit is brought to the collector instead of the other way around. After beginning this journey 7 years ago, this first year of test, in the unforgivable environment of the high seas, strongly indicates that our vision is attainable. At the beginning of our mission to rid the ocean of plastic garbage, which wouldn't actually be effective until we actually stop dumping plastic and using non-disposable plastic, which is interesting how, you know, we don't go to the source. I mean, and I'm not just talking about planting plastic straws here. I'm talking about redoing our entire commercial consumerist infrastructure here, which has accumulated for decades within our sights. So Slatt is very optimistic. He's an optimistic guy. Hey, he's got millions of dollars to spend and he can drop out of college. Because he had a great idea and he went to TED. Because apparently, all the other institutions of our society, scientific or otherwise, weren't working on this problem. They weren't collecting investors. It was up to the Slatt guy. It was up to TED. TED, which is basically, you know, a forum for millionaires to invest in, you know, feel-good projects. So, is this a feel-good project? Well, it feels good right now. It doesn't feel good to me that it took almost, you know, 8 to 10 years to implement even the prototype. And, yeah. But, I mean, I guess it's long-term. Another 10 years and we'll have a fleet of these things. Another 10 years and most of it, maybe the project will be half complete, you know. Once fully operational, the ocean cleanup will return plastic to land for recycling. The timing of that phase of the mission is contingent upon further testing. And that's the end of that. So, okay. Clean up the ocean. Great. Great. But, let's see. But if you think that's great, maybe our transition to a carbon neutral economy will cause more pollution and trash in the, ocean. How? Well, here's a story from the BBC. Story is, electric car future may depend on deep sea mining. Written by David Schuckman, the science editor, living in Spain. And it's got a picture of an excavator of some type called the Apollo 2. It's a prototype deep sea mining machine. Deep sea mining. That sounds like it, you know, that sounds like nothing could go wrong. Okay, the future of electric cars, particularly electric cars, may depend on mining critically important metals on the ocean floor. That's the view of the engineer leading the major European investigation into the new sources of key elements. Demand is soaring for the metal cobalt, an essential ingredient in batteries and abundant in rocks on the seabed. Now, for greater context, cobalt is currently mostly from Africa, mined by almost, if not completely, slave labor. And I did cover a little bit of that in the past episodes. Lawrence Lejeune, who's running the EU project, says the transition to electric cars means we need those resources, in quotes. We need those resources. The clarion call of all imperialism. Imperialism, the last stage of capitalism. Anyway. He was speaking during a unique set of underwater experiments designed to assess the impact of extracting rocks from the ocean floor in calm waters, 15 kilometers from the coast of Magdalena in southern Spain. A prototype mining machine was lowered to the seabed and driven by remote control. cameras attached to the Apollo second machine. They're calling it Apollo. I don't know why. It's deep sea, so why not call it Poseidon? I don't know. They're calling it Apollos 2. Crucially monitored how the aluminum track stirred up clouds of sand and silt as they advanced. Creates a dust plume as it goes. An array of instruments was positioned nearby to measure how far these clouds were carried on the currents. The risk of seabed mining smothering marine life over a wide area is one of the largest concerns. So what is deep sea mining? Which doesn't actually exist as an industry yet. But these engineers are on it! It's hard to visualize, but imagine open cast mining taking place at the bottom of the ocean, where huge remote controlled machines would excavate rocks from the seabed and pump them up to the surface. The concept has been talked about for decades, but until now, it's been thought too difficult to operate in high-pressure, pitch-black conditions, such as 5 kilometers down. Now the technology is advancing to the point where dozens of government and private ventures are weighing up the potential for mines on the ocean floor. Why would anyone bother with that? Short answer is demand. Demand is up. Electric cars. The rocks of the seabed are far richer and gotta build those Tesla trucks out of something, you know? And we gotta have those Tesla trucks. Gotta. Looks like the car that I from the racing games I played on N64. So cool. So the triangle, strong shape. So masculine. I was getting hard on just looking at it. I was hot for the green energy. Billions of potato-sized rocks known as nodules litter the abysmal plain of the Pacific and other oceans. Notice we just talked about cleaning up the trash from the Pacific Ocean, and now we're talking about kicking up large dust plumes. But these oceans are brimming with cobalt, suddenly highly sought after as the boom in production of batteries gathers pace. At the moment, most of the world's cobalt is mined in the Congo, where for years there's been allegations of child labor. Again, allegations. It's happening. Child labor, environmental damage, and of course widespread corruption. Because where there's money, there's inequality. Expanding production there is not straightforward, which is leading mining companies to, where there's surplus, there's inequality. Expanding production there is not straightforward, which is leading mining companies to weigh the potential advantages of getting it from seabeds. Lawrence, who's in charge of the EU project known as Blue Nodules, said, "It's not difficult to access. You don't have to go deep into tropical forests or deep into mines." Oh, so we don't have to burn down the rainforest now. Now we just have to, you know, poison the oceans. It's readily available on the seafloor. It's almost like potato harvesting, only 5 kilometers deep on the ocean. It makes it sound so fun, so simple. We just need those rocks. And as he says, society faces a choice. There's a choice, binary choice. There is maybe a future, an alternative ways of making batteries, and some manufacturers are exploring them, but current technology requires cobalt. Quote, "If you want to make a fast change, which I do, you need cobalt quick, and you need a lot of it. If you want to make a lot of batteries, you need the resources to do that." So we're also assuming that renewable energy economy requires all the batteries, which at the moment does. But there are ways of storing energy that don't require batteries. There are mechanical ways of storing energy. I love water batteries. They recently calculated that meeting the just the UK's targets for electric cars by 2050, because, you know, we gotta keep the car-based infrastructure, but we just gotta switch to electrics and then it's fine. But this would require nearly twice the world's current output of cobalt. So what are the risks? Ah, risks, mish. Just like the risk of oil spills from the XL pipelines. Just like the risk from deep sea oil drilling in the Gulf. The small, minimal risk. Just go forward. We need that oil. We need the minerals for the batteries. Just need them. Ugh. No one can be entirely sure, which makes the research off Spain highly relevant. It's widely accepted that whatever is in the path of the mining machines will be destroyed. There's no argument about that. But what's uncertain is how far the damage will reach, in particular the size of the plumes of silt and sand churned up and the distance they will travel, potentially endangering marine life far beyond the mining site. And the mining sites, of course, will just be limited to certain areas, right? What are limits, right? What are limits in a capitalist economy? An illusion. Well, it's really the other way around. The chief scientist on board, oh, there's a scientist as well as engineers, Hirko Senu of the Dutch Marine Research Institute, points out that life in the deep Pacific, where mining is likely to start first, has adapted to the usually crystal clear conditions. So for any organisms feeding by filter, waters that are so suddenly filled with stirred up sediment would be threatening. Many species are unknown or not described or let alone do not know how they will respond to the activity. We can only estimate. Because we don't even have a handle on the diversity and the type of life that is in the deep sea. And in life in the, you know, less deep sea depends on the life in the deep sea, and life on land depends on life in the oceans. So keep that in mind when, like, why should I care about anglerfish? With every new human activity, it's often difficult to foresee all of the consequences of that in the long term. What is new here is that we are entering an environment that is almost completely untouched. Could deep sea mining be made less damaging? Asked the writer. Ralph Langerdorf thinks so. Of course the engineers on the project think so. They wouldn't be doing the project if they thought it would be too damaging. That would require a conscience. He's the engineer in charge of the Apollo 2 mining machine, and he believes the design will minimize any impacts. Like Lawrence de Jongens, he works for the Dutch marine engineering giant Royal IHC, and he says his technology can help reduce the environmental effects. Limit the effects, sure. The machine is meant to cut a very shallow, just like limiting the dangerous effects of fracking. The engineers are on it. They're on it, and they're so good at their jobs, right? I think Dilbert logic can apply to my, you know, in substitute of the not, you know, deep criticism I'm making of engineering profession. At least when it comes to interacting with the environment and natural systems, because they think in terms of like individual parts and outcomes, and they're not thinking holistically. Machine is meant to cut a very shallow slice into the top 6 to 10 centimeters of the seabed, less than a foot. Lifting the nodules, its tracks are made of a lightweight aluminum to avoid sinking too far into the surface. Wrap up the hour. Silt and sand stirred up by the extraction process should then be channeled into special vents at the rear of the machine and released in a narrow stream to try to avoid the plume spreading too far. We're always changing the environment, that's for sure. Yes, change the environment, like climate change? Not that it's the same process, mind you, but we're talking about, even if it's a shallow bit, it's still kicking up the sand from the seabed, which is unnatural. And yeah, just like pumping CO2 into the atmosphere, it doesn't seem like it's much of an effect at the time, but the effects are, in the long term, are wide-ranging and complex and affect us more than we could ever imagine. But these guys aren't being paid to imagine all the possible consequences of destroying deep marine life. They're being paid to meet the demand for cobalt. I asked them if deep sea mining is now a realistic prospect. One day it's going to happen, especially with the rising demand for special metals, and they're there on the seafloor. You know, it's 'cause you can't fight markets. If there's demand, so it's going to happen. There's nothing you can do about it, hippie. We've got to have perpetual war. We've got to get the oil. We've got to have fracking. We've got to dig up the cobalt. And we gotta have fascists in charge of Bolivia so we can have access to lithium. It's just it's the way it's gotta be. It is what it is. Who decides if it goes ahead? Mining in territorial waters can be approached by an individual government. That happened a decade ago when Papua New Guinea gave the go-ahead to a Canadian company, Nautilus Minerals, to mine gold and copper from hydrothermal vents in the Bismarck Sea. So this is around Indonesia. Since then, the project has been repeatedly delayed as the company ran short of funds and the prime minister of the country called on for a 10-year memorandum on deep-sea mining. So it appears the policymakers, or particularly likely social movements on the ground, pressured them to think a little better of this. A Nautilus Minerals representative told me that the company is being restructured and that they remain hopeful of starting to mine. Meanwhile, nearly 30 other ventures are eyeing areas of ocean floor beyond national waters, and these are regulated by a UN body called the International Seabed Authority. It has issued licenses for exploration and is due next year to publish the rules that would govern future mining. Goody, goody. The EU's Blue Nodules project involves a host of different institutions and countries. You know, because the default is, that's the default in liberal capitalism. Okay, we'll allow you to harm the environment, but we'll make some rules so you don't destroy it completely. And, you know, have our rivers on fire. But, you know, we'll just choke ourselves slowly. We'll change the climate slowly. We'll poison ourselves slowly. You know, I think it just slows things down, which, a few more generations. But I know this is supposed to be the fun episode, but the way I'm talking, like, I'm having fun. Because the reaction I'm having is more anger, not sadness. The vessel used for the underwater research off Spain, the Santorino de Gamboya, is operated by the Spanish National Research Council. So this is a public-private venture. We just talked about the need for deep-sea mining so we can switch to electric cars. I want to talk about how switching to electric cars is meaningless exercise and futility. happy, happy, joy, joy. And then into how renewables alone cannot end / adapting us to the climate crisis. And that's a bit longer, so I want to make sure I have enough time for that. And we'll see where the rest of the show takes us. So thank you very much. Let's see, can I think of anything else? I plugged Patreon. I plugged my social media, so it's Facebook and Twitter. Website, 3lefts.news. We'll archive there. And so thank you very much. And have a good one.
Broken wings, it's hard to wiggle your legs came down, yeah, yeah. And running, it's so easy to do with your ankles bound, yeah, yeah. And breathing, it's so easy to do when you're 6 feet on the ground, yeah, yeah. But I feel the weight of the world and it's dragging me down. Feel the weight of the world and it's dragging me down. Feel the weight of the world and it's dragging me down. Feel the weight of the world and it's dragging me down. Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess it would be pretty nice if I could get a couple dollars and a few bags of rice. I'm trying to feed my family on a minimum wage, but the debt keeps rising, it just feels like slaves. And I keep rubbing two dimes together, trying to save up enough for some stormy weather. But the wind keeps blowing and the rain keeps on falling. The debt collection agencies just keep on calling. My bank shut down due to insolvent funds. I'm starting to think this problem's gonna be solved with guns. Rockefeller sitting at the helm of a tanker and a bailout only been designed for the bankers. Passing legislation that nobody can read. Corporations running rampant with unchecked greed. So now I'm sitting on the corner begging for change. I can't believe in. I wish it was even Steven, but these screws keep on deceiving. While their bosses keep on teaming and the family's still grieving about the peace they're not achieving. Man, I think I must be dreaming. And I'm
feeling the weight of the world and it's dragging me down.
She's never been much of a friend of mine. Time I wave at her, she only left me behind. I can't get alone, it's just a sign of the times. Commission reports covering up for government crimes. The president's plan's supposed to raise the bar, but 15 bucks a paycheck won't get me that far. My refund check, I hope will give me a boost, but all we get is all these chickens coming home to roost. The bone market jug ran away with my spoon. The fat cat stole the cradle out from under the moon. The Titanic going down. I play this tiny violin because there's no hope for a turnaround. I pray for retribution or perhaps the Constitution. All I get is problem, reaction, then solution. I make my contribution to this state of execution. Hope that natural evolution leads to a new revolution. And I'm feeling the weight of the world and it's dragging me down. Feeling the weight of the world and it's dragging me down. Feeling the weight of the world and it's dragging me down. Feeling the weight.
All right, we're back to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Leftist reading hour for deep analysis of moving towards post-capitalism, commons economy, and grassroots democracy as its kind of base goals. Trying to prepare the ground and get us all kind of thinking differently for going in a different direction for the curious or the committed. The stories that are not, in this case, in episodes like these, I'm not reading stories from that are written by leftists, but I'm giving my leftist takes on them. The need for deep sea mining was it's going to happen, says the engineers, fatalistic in their ways, or at least market thinking of markets, because we need the transition to electric cars. Hey, you know, we'll destroy the ocean beds in various places. But we'll at least have all the minerals we need to switch to electric cars. Well, let's see how that's going. From CNBC, headline, surging SUV demand is canceling out the environmental benefit from electric cars. Published by Pippa Stevens, if worldwide demand for SUVs continues to grow at its current pace, the carbon emissions from these larger vehicles will outweigh the benefits from electric ones. A new study from the International Energy Agency, which I think is under the UN, found the number of SUVs on the road around the world grew from 35 million in 2010 to 200 million last year. How's that for a 10-year challenge? Representing 60% of the increase of the global car fleet over those 8 years. So its SUV carbon footprint has grown as well. The change in CO2 emissions by the energy sector, 2010 to 2018 units, as a graph, SUVs is second to power vehicles. The surge in popularity is having a big, because it's demand, right? It's the people have spoken, they want SUVs, not electric cars. The surge in popularity is having a big impact on the environment since SUVs are less fuel efficient than their smaller counterparts. Now, some car companies, like Chrysler, have stopped making sedans entirely. They're only making SUVs and trucks. From 2010 to 2018, SUVs were the second largest contributor to the global increase in carbon emissions behind the power sector. The study found this places SUVs ahead of trucks and even aviation in terms of its carbon footprint. Now, we're not talking about all types of emissions and pollution, but we're just talking about carbon footprint, mentioning that. The study also found that 100% of the increase in demand for oil for passenger cars was driven by the popularity of larger vehicles. Demand is up for oil, even. Gotta keep fighting those wars for oil. Gotta keep drilling, gotta keep fracking. If consumers, that's in quotes, appetite for SUVs continues to grow at a similar pace seen in the last decade, SUVs would add nearly 2 million barrels a day in global oil demand by 2040, offsetting the savings from the nearly 150 million electric cars. So that I think that's saying that if like electric car usage grew to where the sellers of electric cars would want it, which again would require double the amount of mineral mining that we currently have. That means double the amount of exploitation of developing countries, black and brown people, so on and so on. It's also intersectional. 48% of car sales in the U.S. last year were SUVs, which was the highest percentage worldwide. But other countries are catching up. They're catching up to us in buying SUVs. Large cars can be seen as a status symbol, and sales are rising in countries like China and India, where the middle class there is growing. Sounds like middle class is what's got to go. The shift towards bigger, less fuel-efficient cars is somewhat at odds with the auto market generally, where heavy R&D spending is fueling developments in energy-efficient vehicles. I read the words, but I'm not seeing the effect. Given the advances in electric vehicles, as well as the knowledge that SUVs are less fuel-efficient, the researchers called the growing number of larger cars and the impact nothing short of surprising. They're surprised. Not at the end of that story. So very short and sweet. Just a simple, on the one hand, all those new electric cars have, as far as, you know, helping the environment, has been rendered completely meaningless by the market saturation of SUVs. Yeah. So that leads us to, when I run through these greenwashing stories, and by greenwashing I mean taking the market, meaning capitalist corporations, they put forward solutions to the climate crisis, or like, we're doing our part to in being green. You know, we caulked our windows. We have increased our energy efficiency 20%. We have bought electric vehicles. These things are not either going to be or going to address the climate crisis overall, and they're not even helping us adapt to the new realities of climate change once the climate has effectively changed to where, I mean, it has been, but to the point where it is distinguishably different than how it was last century in terms of average temperatures, which of course have already changed, in terms of the frequency of large storms, that's already changed. We're in the middle of it. But when I do these greenwashing stories in previous episodes, I keep the critique to basically what I just said. Now, I have a story here from resilience.org. Resilience, like many other kind of words, become buzzwords in the hands of corporations and corporate power, but can be meaningful words when accurately describing things that are actually materially make us more resilient to change, but rather to crisis. So the story is, it bears repeating, Renewables Alone Won't End the Climate Crisis, by Andrew Nikapuk, originally published by The Tree. Well, it's T-Y-E-E, so I'm not quite sure how to say that. Tree. Published this month. So this one's a bit longer. So let's go into the real critique. So usually the critique is, I just say, you can't just change the technology we're using. We need to use less of it. Okay, so let's go into a nitty-gritty argument. In a recent column about the dismal Canadian election, so this is from a Canadian perspective, I wrote that most Canadians and their lackluster political parties have no real appreciation of the physical and moral challenges posed by the disruptive forces of climate change. Although the media still portrays climate change as some vague threat to quote-unquote, the environment, and not our civilization, it is really a self-made blitzkrieg that is already destabilizing a highly energy-intensive and complex human civilization. But we are only making more complex by, say, adding deep-sea mining and all the other things into the mix. Greta Thunberg has spoken prophetically, our civilized house is on fire. But our collective politicians, blinded by ideology and technological illusions, refuse to panic, let alone call the community fire department. Now, I want to note that even if they did panic and see how dire the situation is, I think they would still react with a powerlessness. Like, because they themselves, for the most part, feel and think of themselves as not being in power. Like, they're still under the control of, when we say that they're blinded by ideology, there's ghosts. There's these ideas, the market, the laws of economics. There's these the laws of power that restrict them. They can't act to do what needs to be done or to do the right thing, to put it in a more mild way, because they are restricted. You know, the way they do interviews, the way they speak about their jobs, even candidly, unless they truly are really great performers and behind closed doors, they're laughing in the bag. But I get the feeling, like, when it comes to the media commentators and such, that they actually do think in these ideologically blind ways. That even if the problem is as bad as it is, that they wouldn't know what to do, and they wouldn't know how to address it. Because the forces of capital and the rules of our economy, as it currently is, restricts them as much as anything. Well, it's what really controls them. So they're not really in control either. That's why we have to do system change and not just change who's in office. Because whoever is in office is going to feel powerless. Let's see, another point on that. They behave as though they can just build another house somewhere else on Mars and then watch the conflagration on Netflix. The results of climate catastrophe. Now, in that previous analysis, I quoted a Colorado professor, and this is his last piece in the series, I guess, Roger Picklett Jr., who recently noted in Forbes that if we really wanted to reach zero carbon emissions by 2050, as many politicians seem to put the goal, we should solely choose wind power as the solution. But if we did, we need to build and deploy 1,500 wind turbines on about 300 square miles every day for the next 30 years. We can't do that, of course, because of physics and economics. Picklett was simply illustrating the scale of the challenge if we thought that renewables could do all of the work for us. But a great many readers questioned his math. Others questioned his motivation. Others questioned my sanity in quoting such a fellow. Having written about energy for 30 years, says the writer, and my best scribbling on the matter remains The Energy of Slaves, previous work, I thought Picklett's numbers, which can vary with wind power due to location and size of blades, were largely accurate and conveyed the enormity of the task at hand, especially if we think our energy crisis is just a substitution problem. His numbers are also a reminder that as of 2018, solar power provided only 2% of global energy, with wind roughly about 5%. In other words, we have a long way to go if we choose to reduce emissions by simply replacing fossil fuels with wind turbines. As ecologist Bill Rees noted in his recent tree analysis, the green energy transition is not really happening, whatever technocrats and Time magazine are telling you. Because the way they talk about energy policy and stuff, it's like, it's happening. It's happened, folks. And Democrats in my area that I associate with, they're really great people, but I feel they have the mindset that we actually can transition all of our energy use to renewables. And it's happening, that there are these new solar companies. They look at the growth of the solar energy industry in America, and they see it's happening. It's happening. But globally speaking, as well as in America, I don't believe it's happening. Peakley, he said, ignored some data on existing renewables. Okay, I asked David Hughes, one of Canada's most esteemed energy analysts, to comment on Picklett's math. They call him Picklett. And here's what he said. Picklett, he said, ignored some data on existing renewables such as hydro dams, but basically his math is close to correct. Hughes added that it's physically impossible to replace all primary fossil fuel energy on a business-as-usual scale with renewables. And I think many greenwashing people and other sustainability advocates already know this, and they already talk about this. But I'm not seeing it in action. Like, they're saying, we need to change business as usual. Well, the way they're going about their advocacy and strategies of action, it's not changing business as usual at all. They think it's a matter of culture in companies, but culture is downstream from politics. There's the actual structures of these companies. Like, that needs to change if you're going to change the culture. Because it's just, that's what greenwashing means. To just say we're going to have cultural change and everyone will save energy and use less. That's not how we use less. We use less by planning on using less. We actually have to not just think about it, we gotta do it together as in an organized fashion. To Hughes, the implications are clear. And this is an ecologist, an energy analyst. What this means is that we have to look at downsizing, degrowth, using less. And I've talked about that in previous episodes. The math doesn't work to keep the party going with renewables. Ecologist Rees delivered the same message a week ago in The Tree, another publication. Note that Hughes is not saying we shouldn't build lots of renewables. What he is saying is that we need to radically reduce energy consumption and use renewables to actually retire fossil fuel infrastructure. To date, the evidence shows that we have largely used renewables to consume more energy. It's like a stopgap. It's just to continue business as usual. Greenwashing continues business. It's a cover to just keep things as they are. And that's my argument in my pessimism when, looking at a story like how Bill Gates invests in these massive solar projects that can melt aluminum, that can replace industrial processes. Now we don't, like, these things could only be done with fossil fuels before, and he has invested in the engineers to prove that you can do it with solar. I'm like, okay, great, we can keep using steel and aluminum. But an ecologically balanced future, to me, and in reality, wouldn't have those things. And this guy points it out as well. Our civilization, which will embrace a collapse before it commits to such a plan in energy reduction, now behaves like a Moloch. The child eater keeps gobbling more energy and belching more emissions. Since 1859, global energy consumption has increased by an average of 2.5% a year. It shows no sign of slowing down. And let's look at the problem another way. The Great Depression, which put millions out of work, represented a 30% drop in economic activity worldwide. But that economic collapse resulted in only a 10% drop in global carbon emissions. Now, we know this because of the ice core work that scientists have done, which use ice tree, quote-unquote tree rings, but it uses the layers of ice developed to show how much carbon was put in the air those years. Yet we need to bring 42 billion tons of yearly emissions down to zero in 30 years. The destructive ethos of our civilization. So he's pointing out that even like dropping economic activity 30%, putting us in a Great Depression, it doesn't drop emissions. We have to restructure our economy completely new. How? What kind of economy? Well, you're listening to a leftist program. And so draw the conclusions you may. I believe a socialist economy where each according to one's ability, each according to one's need, is radically different and more efficient than whoever's willing to pay the most money gets it. Well, no, not always who's willing to pay, who has the money gets it. Another point going on, the destructive ethos of our civilization demands growth and greatness. Got to make ourselves great again, Its unmanageable complexity has created unmanageable complexity, right? So our economy, our society, it's too complex to actually be managed, to actually be planned out. Has created an insatiable addiction to cheap energy. It's necessary. But just as it's necessary to mine more cobalt for batteries. But Pikelet's numbers also reflect the different physical character of renewables. They simply don't behave like fossil fuels. In some ways, that's probably a good thing. They provide less energy, require more space, and offer fewer surpluses. Where the surpluses, there's inequality. Keep that in mind. So that's why there's a lot of optimism that a renewable energy economy will be one that's less has less inequality, less division between poverty and excessive. But then there's power density. Different forms of energy behave like different groups of food. Cheese, for example, contains a lot more calories than a potato, just as fossil fuels offer more bang for the buck than most renewables do. As a result, renewables typically require more surface area to produce an equivalent amount of power. Now, by surface area, we're talking about land. Like, say, an oil drilling pad is less land use than a solar power plant. Another ecologist, Valkov Smil, and David Frindley, a fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, have hammered on this energy nail for a long time. As Frindley explains, a consequence of low energy density is that larger amounts of material or resources are then needed to provide the same amount of energy as the denser material or fuel. So it takes more materials, buildings like, say, the wind turbines, than the fuel pad, than the oil rig. Here's one example. The world's largest concentrated solar project sits in Morocco and occupies 25 square kilometers of desert. Put in football field units, that's 3,500 of them. The 9 billion Osmarat solar power station produces enough electricity for 1 million people, roughly the population of the city of Prague. But 1 million people is easily understood, right? But Morocco has a population of 35 million. To provide solar power for everyone, using the big project model would take roughly 315 billion and 875 square kilometers. Here's another illustration. A lithium-ion battery, which requires a lot of rare earth mining, as covered by this program in past episodes and last hour, can contain about half megajoule of energy per kilogram of battery. In contrast, gasoline, you know, as a fuel in a container, contains 46 megajoules of energy per kilogram versus a half. Okay? So power density explains why fossil fuels represent the energy equivalent of fast food and are equally as addictive. Although I don't like talking about energy use as food, but whatever. David McKay, a British engineer, deftly illustrated the realities of power density in a book called Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air. McKay, by the way, thinks society must make a dramatic change and be aware of the math at the same time. He also uses, and again, I'm outlaying that just switching to renewables is not a drastic change because it still assumes that we need to be using hundreds of megawatts of energy, that we need, that office buildings need to keep their lights on all night, that we need all that lighting for parking lots, that we need all that energy to fuel electric cars, to charge them. That changing those mindsets is the drastic change. He also uses energy figures that most people can understand, kilowatts per hour, and the same numbers that appear on our, it says hydro bills. But that's because in Canada, most of all of their energy comes from hydropower, at least locally speaking. So much so that they're going to sell a bunch of it to New York, or at least there's a deal in the works to do that. The average person in England or Europe, for example, consumes 125 kilowatts per hour a day. Really? Well, okay, that's not just electricity in the home, but that's like everywhere. Because monthly, I use 30. Most of that energy now comes from fossil fuels. Driving a fossil fuel car consumes about 40 kilowatt hours of that total. Okay, so yeah, so we're factoring in driving, we're factoring in all energy use. I feel like I'm pretty slim. I have yet to calculate my carbon footprint. Maybe I should do that. But there are issues with those carbon footprint calculators, but I think it probably better than not doing it at all. It is hard to make that up with wind power. According to McKay, you would have to plant 10% of the windiest part of Britain with offshore wind farms to yield just 20 kilowatt hours per person. So 20 out of 125. So it's just, and by the way, this is stuff I learned in architecture school. When I studied how to make a house zero carbon, the math was put out before us in graph and other forms. And it was very, very, very illustrative. Pretty much boils down to this. If you're going to make a house, and I'm talking about like a thousand square foot house, but it could be a 1500, you know, three bedroom house. If you're going to make a house zero emissions, or zero net zero energy, only 30% of the energy use can actually come from active sources, you know. So we talk in terms of passive and active systems. So 70% of the heating and cooling, the electricity, you know, whatever use of appliances has to come from passive sources. Passive heating means having more windows and shading in the summer. Passive heating, you know, means running pipes through the ground. Or having a big rock in your house so that, you know, the sun during the day hits the rock, heats it up, and then the rock radiates heat in the night. You know, those are passive systems. So that way, you only need to cover 30% of your energy needs, your heating, cooling, what have you, with renewables. That is essentially what the math bears out with this article, that we can cover 30% of what we currently do with renewables, but no more. Even if we get the efficiencies up, like, you know, with solar power and whatever, it's roughly still going to be, we can cover 30% of what we do. The rest has to come from passive systems. So socially, you know, our whole society and our industry, like, what does that mean to be passive? It means that it needs to come from the ecology. It needs to come from nature. It can't come from gasoline. You know, with farming, a lot of our farming has tons of energy inputs. If we farm ecologically, we can take those energy inputs out, and then we only need energy use to, say, drive the tractors and the transportation. Because that's, roughly speaking, just a guess, 30% of the needed energy for farming and getting food to your table. That can be covered with electric vehicles and electric tractors and whatever. But everything else, in terms of the fertilizers and the pest control, that has to be done ecologically. Just to put it in that sense. You know, we're talking about energy in your home, solar panels, wind turbine can cover 30% of your use. Everything else has to come from efficiency. That means more installation. That means more passive systems. So that's the big wraparound. But let's continue this a bit more here. The story gets more complicated. To replace just one quarter of energy demand with biofuels would require planting 75% of Britain's land mass with plantations of switchgrass or black locust. 75%. So basically there is not enough land to actually, you know, have forests and other ecologies. And that means just replacing with monoculture, which would basically destroy all life, to have enough biofuel. Just replace a quarter, right, to say run your cars on biofuel. We just can't do biofuel. We can't do that. To rest just 4% of Britain's energy consumption from ocean wave power would require the construction of 500 kilometers of wave farms along the coast. So even we build massive build out of renewable energy infrastructure, we can only cover a fraction of our current use. That's the message here. And to provide half of that 125 kilowatt hours per person, demand with wind would require filling a sea area twice the size of Wales with offshore wind farms. So that's, you know, it's, yeah, that's just half of it. It's just not doable. Quote, someone who wants to live on renewable energy but expects the infrastructure associated with that renewable not to be as large or intrusive is deluding himself, notes McKay. He is right. turn it to our country. The U.S. National Renewable Energy Laboratory, yes, it is surprising that such an organization still exists in the Trump era, Trump presidency. I don't know why we call it an era. 8 years is not a frickin' era. Okay. I guess it's just a quick word. This agency calculated that in 2018, last year, if the U.S. transitioned to 80% renewables by 2050, the power sector would occupy 15% of the landmass in at least 12 states. And I think that was their, they made a report of how to have a renewable energy economy and what it would take and how it could work. Now that study has been buried, but it wasn't a story. It wasn't promoted, for the obvious political reasons. Whenever ecologist Smill looks at a wind turbine, he sees fossil fuels. Coal-fired blast furnaces melting steel. The diesel-powered machines that mix cement. And more fossil-fueled machines erecting steel turbines. And that is how I see things as well. So I guess I think like an ecologist already as well. That's why I kind of get saddened and angry with renewable energy build-out. Because the way we're doing it with materials that are high energy and require burning of fossil fuels. Cement, steel, etc. Now, I've explored, and it can be explored, how wind turbines can be made of wood and other materials, that buildings can be made mostly out of wood, that we can give up building out of concrete, or we can make concrete out of different ways that don't require cement, because cement is really where the pollution and energy comes in. Even if turbine blades are made from lightweight plastic, composite materials, but, you know, they should be made of wood. But right now they're made of plastic. So ban all the straws you want. We're building our renewable energy out of rare minerals mined out of the ocean floor in coming decades and plastic. Smill estimates that to generate just a quarter of the global electric demand would require 450 million metric tons of steel. And to make all that steel would require somewhere between 600 million tons of coal. To make steel, you need coal. Now, I think the Gates Foundation and their engineering would be, you know, to make steel with solar power, but you still need materials, and that still requires coal and iron ore. Yeah. Nonetheless, a well-sited and well-built wind turbine would generate as much energy as it embodies in less than a year, Red Smill. However, all of it will be in the form of intermittent electricity, while its production, installation, and maintenance remain critically dependent on specific fossil energies. This is why there's the talk of using gas, natural gas, as the bridge fuel. To maintain all of our renewable energy, we still need to be burning fossil fuels. But for the record, Smill thinks society is doing everything wrong with energy at the moment. Our cars and homes have gotten bigger. We fly everywhere with feckless Greek gods. Oh, like feckless Greek gods. And we grow our food more energy intensively than ever before. We throw away 40% of it. We can't even tax the rich. Now, that 40% metric, I'm hearing more and more people repeat it, but I feel like they're kind of repeating it in an inaccurate way. The entire food system throws out 40%. I think the way people are hearing it, they're thinking that 40% of our food waste, all of our food waste, is like at the end, like in the home. It's not in the home. It's all along the whole supply chain. Keep that in mind. Not all individual problems, and people need to stop wasting the food they buy. My point here, and I do not wish to belabor it, is that one of the most effective and direct solutions to reducing emissions must come from radically reducing fossil fuel consumption. But such conservation will radically change our economy, meaning decapitalize it, and de-energize our way of life. We cannot put the fire out in our global house alone with smart cars, windmills, and solar panels. Furthermore, technology is not an energy maker, but an energy cannibal. Supplies of cheap energy drive our technological advances. They don't happen without burning more energy. it's a self-defeating cycle, like the mining of our seas. We're only going to create more ecological catastrophe to switch to electric cars, which then are outsold by SUVs. Ridiculous, right? If the quality or quantity of energy resources dwindles, the power of the technology then declines along with them, notes a U.S. critic, William Oprest, in his brilliant book on failing civilizations called Immoderate Greatness. But there is some good news here, as there usually is. The power density of solar panels is increasing. You can get more solar energy from a smaller space. Heat pumps, roof-mounted solar water heaters, and turning the thermostat down are, of course, no-brainers. High energy prices can and do lower demand, which did occur after recession, but only because we are in recession. The research consistently shows that low energy consuming, and that's why I really get mad at any right wing or whatever who proudly proclaim how our economy is growing, and there's more people working, and it's like, dude, that's worse. That's like, that's not good. You think it's good, but is it really? It's not good. The research consistently shows that low energy consuming cultures tend to be much happier as well than ones like ours. In the 70s, Earl Cook, the renowned Texas geologist, described how cheap fossil fuels had blinded us to the perils of high energy spending by creating its own myths. So this kind of conversation has been going on as long as there's been an environmental movement. We thought that endless growth was good and that technology never delivered diminishing returns. But of course, it does. Now that we must contemplate an energy descent for which our civilization does not have an ethos or a vocabulary. But I would say that ecology provides that vocabulary and ethos. So that's why we're going to talk more ecology. Gotta talk more ecology. And then eventually social ecology. But Cook knew where we must go. Quoting him, I don't know if he's talking from the 70s or maybe he's older now. We must abandon efficiency of production as a social goal and replace it with an efficiency of consumption. We need to favor measures of quality, of achievement, our measure of quality, and we must stop confusing momentum with progress and growth with goodness. So, on that note, earlier this episode, I felt bad because the Green Party wasn't growing, but maybe I just need to think about it a different way. Maybe I need to stop thinking about progress as being the one of momentum, but I'm thinking like a capitalist with my party building. I'm thinking too much like the status quo, and that's why I'm really on the edge of leaving Green Party activism wholesale. I don't know. I'm racking about it. It's what I'm racking about this holiday season. What am I going to be doing in the next year? Am I going to be doing Howie campaigning? Am I going to be doing it out of obligation and it will feel like a chore? Or will the interactions I have and the kind of the way people's eyes light up when an alternative is presented, especially once DNC shenanigans ensue and Bernie's blocked from the nomination. But let's say Bernie does get the nomination. Then the Democratic Party will split in half. Or it'll be like McGovern, and the Democratic base will just not show up for the election. And many will vote for Trump. Don't believe me? You should read what they write about it. So, ending thoughts. We can start by rejecting the Nostrum, that we can stabilize the climate and build a new Jerusalem by solely building renewables. Gotta think ecologically. And then we can do it. I will do my ending housekeeping now, and then I will play music the rest of the hour. Once again, this is the Three Lefts show. Those three lefts make a right. But the lefts stand for anarchism, socialism, and ecology. So today I was boosting ecology, but of course we don't get ecology without some socialism. They are intertwined. That is why this is the three lefts. But I'm an interdenominational leftist, overall a libertarian socialist. And this is a radical leftist reading hour for the curious and committed here at WCAA Community Radio Project. It is not ours unless it is ours. And we are building community media here, so please become a member. We need a base of support. So that's at grandstreetarts.org, I think. And or do a search for WCAA LP The Voice here in Albany. I'm on social media, Facebook and Twitter, Three Left Show. Just do a search. This show can be found podcasted on all available podcasting apps, to my knowledge. If you use one and my show is not findable there, let me know. I would like to know so I can then join it. But I'm on Stitcher. I'm on Spotify, I believe. And, of course, Google Play, iTunes, the standards. And the archive of the show, and that's for the last 10 episodes, full archive of the show, up to 60 episodes, can be found at 3lefts.news. Nothing else. Just 3lefts, numeral 3lefts.news. Where I don't have too much other content there, but as well, I've been posting episodes for the last season. By season, I mean the last few months, with a full description, and sources can be found there as well. All sources are listed, the articles I read, and any supplementary material which I didn't get to. So with that,
and have a great one out there.